The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is brought to you by the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, ensuring long-term growth in the world's greatest salmon fishery through investments in Bristol Bay science, infrastructure, marketing, and quality. The Bristol Bay RSDA. We're on board with you.
This is the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. I'm your host, Mike Mason. During today's program, we'll get the final harvest numbers from Alaska's largest herring fishery and hear about how your tide book may be slightly off. We'll also check in with the Coast Guard about their preseason vessel inspection program. All of that and more is coming up on today's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. This is the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. Last week, an interesting dilemma came to light. The two different versions of tide books freely available around the Dillingham area were found to have different times and heights for the predicted tides of the Nooshigak District as measured at Clark's Point, and neither one of them aligned with the tide tables on NOAA's website. For instance, the afternoon high tide on June 21st could either be at 12:01 p.m. at 18.8 feet, or according to a different tide book, at 1:02 p.m. at 17.4 feet, or somewhere in between. Now, everyone can determine for his or herself how big a deal those discrepancies actually are, but what we wanted to know was, where do you find the most accurate prediction of the Nooshigak Bay tides? KDLG's Dave Binegar reports.
To get the answer, we turn to Stephen Gill, a senior scientist with NOAA's National Ocean Service Center for Operational Oceanographic Products and Services in Maryland. Gill helps explain these kinds of things to us and the general public, and he tells us that the simple answer is that NOAA's website has the most accurate, up-to-date tide tables available.
Those are based upon the latest information, observations of 3 months of data back in the summer of 2012, and we've updated the analysis using a time series analysis package, and we believe these are the most accurate and up-to-date tide predictions for the area.
NOAA did observations at the Clark's Point Station from May 22nd through August 22nd last summer, and that's where the most recent numbers on the website come from. The hard copy versions in print, which are often used by publishers to put together the free tide books available around town, may be based on time and range corrections from another station. In other words, calculating the Clark's Point tides based off observations from, say, Port Moeller. Again, this is why Gill recommends the website.
The ones on the web are based directly upon the observations, no time and range correction to another station somewhere else out of the area. And they're listed. You can see whether it's a subordinate correction or harmonic. If it's harmonic, it's based directly upon the observations, and it's generally more accurate.
Now to the tide books themselves. There are generally two versions floating around town. One, called Alaska Tide Books, is published by Pioneer Publishing. The other, the Dots Fishing Guide, is published by Sun Graphics. Neither one of those books lines up with the NOAA website, though the Dots seems to be the closer of the two. We've spoken with both publishers, and both stand by their numbers, as in there won't be any recalls. But how exactly the discrepancies came about is kind of tricky to unravel.
Part of the problem is NOAA doesn't have any control over, when they take data from our NOAA publications, what they do with it and how they modify it, and we don't have any control or quality control or anything on what happens after we provide the source information. So it's hard for us to track what people have done to the data and why it might be different from our publications or web-based data.
Between the two books, there are occasionally differences of an hour or more in time and sometimes a foot or more in height. From his perspective, in an area that sees a rather large change between high and low tides, Gill says that shouldn't be of too much concern. But being wrong on the tide by an hour can have an impact here, like turning your back on a skiff near the beach only to find it stuck in the mud for the next tide.
I think the best thing to do is to now use as their source of information the information that's on the web. I think if they could recalibrate their tables and use that information from the web everyone will be using the same source information.
Even so, Gill says they lack long-term data sets, and they call these tide predictions for a reason. It doesn't take a senior scientist to know that there will always be differences between what's been predicted in the charts and what fishermen and boaters actually observe on the water.
You know, the observed will run different from the predicted, especially during storms, during abnormal weather events, for sure. And also in that area, depending how much there is for the summertime river runoff season, if there's a substantial amount of river runoff and freshwater flow, the predictions will be off in those upper parts of those estuaries up in Bristol Bay, for sure. So that will add to the uncertainty seasonally.
As far as predicted tides go, KDLG has started using the tables from NOAA's website when we report the tides throughout the day. As for observing the actual tide or choosing which tide book to use, well, that's up to you. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
And to hear NOAA's Stephen Gill give a more detailed and technical explanation of the differences between the predicted tides and last summer's careful observations, go to our website, kdlg.org. This is the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report on listener-supported public radio, KDLG. Listening to the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. Alaska's largest herring fishery came to a close Tuesday. Fish and Game confirms that all of the seafood processors involved with the Togiak Sacro herring fishery quit buying Monday. Tim Sands is the ADF&G area management biologist, and he says all signs point to a healthy and sustainable herring biomass.
For us, for the department, we had plenty of opportunity. We harvested most of both quotas, and biologically, we saw lots of fish. We believe, the forecast was pretty close as far as how much biomass we've documented. We saw lots of spawn. I'm really hopeful and optimistic that this will be one of those years where there's a really good recruit class for herring, that the spawning was really successful, and that the weather is kind of conducive to good herring survival. I don't know, but I'm hopeful that that's the case. So we'll have, 6-7 years from now, we'll have another good crop of herring moving through the fishery.
The total harvest this season came in at just over 28.8 thousand tons of herring. The quota available this year was just over 30,000 tons. The 24 vessels that made up the Perth Seine fleet had a quota of just over 21,000 tons of herring, and they ended up very close to the quota with a harvest of 20.2 thousand tons. The 37 vessels that made up the Gillnet fleet had a quota of just over 9,000 tons, and they hauled in 8.5 thousand. Now that the fishery is closed, Fish and Game is trying to assess the size of the total herring biomass that showed up this season in the Togiak District. That work is ongoing, but Sands announced the largest biomass documented during a survey flight was 90,000 tons. The forecast anticipated an overall herring biomass of 169,000 tons. The herring harvested this season had an average weight of 385 grams. The average weight of the Perth Seine caught fish was 380 grams, and it was 397 for gillnet caught fish. Pre-season, Fish and Game forecasted the average weight would be around 317 grams, which Sands notes was well below the recorded average weight of 385 grams.
What does that mean? Does it mean that the fish grew a lot more over the winter? Does it mean that there was a lot more older fish that are still present than we thought, that the biomass is bigger? It's something we're going to work on over the winter and try and tease out. So I don't have a real solid answer right now, but I do think it means that, there's more biomass there than probably we expected, I guess. It's hard to say for sure, but definitely I think it means, at the very least, it means that we have a very healthy population.
The Togiak Sacro herring fishery has changed in recent years from a massive endeavor involving hundreds of vessels to a much smaller fishery that is primarily governed by the processing capacity of the local processors that buy the herring. This year, 6 processors bought herring, which was up from the 4 processors that bought herring last year. Sands admitted that he has heard the rumors that Silver Bay Seafoods and Togiak Seafoods might join the fishery next year.
I've heard the rumors, and I'm not really going to take any, I can't do anything about rumors until I guess it's closer to the season. It will could certainly change things a little bit.
More processors could mean more fishermen and vessels, which could result in the quota being harvested quicker if there's additional processing capacity next year above this year's estimate of 2.7 thousand tons a day. Sands and his staff are in the process of looking at all of the available data that will be used to write the 2013 Togiak Sacro Herring Fishery Season Summary that Sands hopes to have out somewhere around June 7th. Seafood News is reporting that about 56,000 tons of herring have been harvested from San Francisco up to Togiak. That's up 20% compared to last year. Prices have not been settled, but there has been speculation the price will be up, and KDLG News has heard that at least one company has put forward an initial price for Togiak herring of just $100 a ton. If you have price information to share with KDLG, send us an email to news@kdlg.org. You can also give us a call at 842-5281. A new large seafood processing plant is being constructed this summer in Naknek, and it's expected to be processing herring and salmon next year. However, the prospect of that plant and other users coming online is raising concerns about the viability of the sewage system in the Bristol Bay Borough. Late last year, Silver Bay Seafoods announced plans to enter the Bristol Bay market, and the company is hard at work building their processing facility along the Alaska Peninsula Highway in Naknek. The facility is expected to be about 54,000 square feet in size, and it's believed it will cost upwards of $25 million. For years, many fishermen and other stakeholders in Bristol Bay's massive salmon and herring fisheries have lamented the lack of new processors in the bay, and Silver Bay's entrance is drawing praise. Dan O'Hara is the mayor of the Bristol Bay Borough. He says the company is hard at work constructing the new seafood processing facility.
They're drinking from a fire hose. It's just unbelievable what's going on there. Yeah, all the property has been cleared. All winter long, Lax has been bringing in these big lowboys of gravel from Pavik's pits and stacking it. Right now, everything is leveled off. They're putting in the cement posts and everything into the ground right now. And they plan on operating in 2014.
The Silver Bay plant will be located just up from the Leader Creek plant, and Silver Bay Seafoods apparently put up $2 million for the land. While some of the processors in the Naknek area have expanded their facilities in recent years, the Silver Bay plant will be the first brand-new plant in many, many years, and O'Hara believes Silver Bay will be a very valuable addition to Bristol Bay's processing sector. However, he says another large processing plant poses some challenges for the Bristol Bay Borough.
People are really excited about it. There's always a downside to the good capital projects, and then all of a sudden your infrastructure is being taxed, such as your septic system, and that's being really overtaxed.
O'Hara says the borough's sewage system is the next capital project priority for the borough because it's old and needs to be upgraded to handle the tremendous load placed on it during the busy summer months.
The legislature gave a tax incentive for value-added product coming out of Bristol Bay. In other words, if we had to put another reefer in or another flaying machine or a skinless boneless, these types of things really encourage the processor to upgrade because I would venture to say we're 90% value added coming out of Bristol Bay now, the way Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation has given flush decks, insulated fish holds, all kinds of incentives. Peter Pan is having you put down 3/4 inch foam, and fishermen are beginning to find out it's really good on the knees. So those type of things have increased the volume of things that are happening in a Bristol Bay borough, the Naknek. In other words, Trident has put up a 3-story bunkhouse. AGS has put up a 2-story bunkhouse. They're putting up another – AGS is going to put up another 2-story bunkhouse. We have a meal plant coming in. Silver Bay is coming in. And instead of doing 175,000 gallons about mid-July or maybe the 7th to the 15th or so, we're doing 475,000 gallons a day. That system is not going to work. If it was good, and it is old, it goes down by the shoreline. And we put $435,000 into a pump and an overland line. Should it get too busy, we could use that as to take some of the pressure off. And we can't have the septic system shut down either because all the processors depend on that. So there you go.
O'Hara says the solution to the problem is obvious, a new or significantly upgraded sewage system for the borough. He confirms the borough is currently exploring its options.
A lot of the present septic system you can use. You know, it is good. It's good pipe, and some of the pump stations obviously going to have to be upgraded. And the material that we bought for temporary overland to go to the sewer system, to the holding ponds, that can be put into the new system. It's just going to – it's going to be a three-phase, probably a $20 million estimated now, and with two new lagoons that we're going to move back away from the shoreline.
The Bristol Bay Borough didn't get any money for their aging sewage system in the FY 2014 state capital budget, but it's likely the borough will be requesting some funding in future years. You're listening to the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report here on KDLG.
The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is made possible in part by the Alaska Independent Fishermen's Marketing Association, 800-816-3741, or on the web at aifma.org.
Welcome back to the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. Bristol Bay's massive commercial salmon fishery is right around the corner, as like previous years, the U.S. Coast Guard is sending safety inspectors to the region. Inspectors will be in the Dillingham area from June 13th through the 22nd. They'll be in the Igigik region from June 10th through the 15th. Inspectors will be in the Naknek King Salmon area from June 10th through the 22nd. Last year, the Coast Guard was preparing for the preseason safety inspections to become mandatory, but the Coast Guard and Maritime Transportation Act of 2012 modified the law to require that dockside safety exams become mandatory in 2015. That means the safety exams being offered this season in the Bristol Bay region will be voluntary. Chief John Jones is the Commercial Fishing Vessel Safety Coordinator for Coast Guard Sector Anchorage. He says the goal of the exams is to make sure fishermen have the necessary safety equipment.
If they do not have one of the carriage requirements, we afford them an opportunity to correct that deficiency. If they need a new fire extinguisher, it's just a matter of, you know, running up to one of the local stores, see if they have it, purchase that, get it back on board, and then the inspection team will come back out, verify that you took care of that discrepancy, and sign it off and complete the exam from there.
Vessels that pass the voluntary exams are then allowed to display a Coast Guard decal indicating the vessel has all of the needed paperwork and safety equipment. Chief Jones says the decals are good for 2 years.
And then they'll also get a copy of the exam that kind of goes with the decal, which they will need to keep on board as well. I must say, though, that having the decal does not exclude you from getting a Coast Guard at sea boarding. You are still subject to being boarded by the Coast Guard while you're operating.
Coast Guard inspectors are currently scheduled to be in the Igigik area from June 10th through the 15th and in the Naknek King Salmon area from June 10th through the 22nd. Inspectors are scheduled to be in the Dillingham area from June 13th through the 22nd. Chief Jones says one of the easiest ways to be prepared for a safety inspection is to visit the website, fishsafe.info.
And on there is a checklist generator where the owner or the representative would put in all the boat's particular information. It'll create a detailed checklist based off the answers that are provided. That checklist that's generated is pretty much the exact same checklist that our inspection team uses at the time of the exam. So that's a really, really good way to get prepared, and it actually saves a lot of time. And believe it or not, folks go through that checklist, and they'll realize that they don't have everything they need. And so they'll go through that, get it taken care of, and, life's easier.
Chief Jones admits that some fishermen are hesitant to volunteer for a safety inspection, but he says most fishermen want an exam.
They love seeing us. They hate when they miss us. We try to get to everyone and get out there at a time where it's, you know, conducive for the max amount of participation, if you will. But we do miss some folks, and I'll apologize up front for that. But for the most part, people like seeing us coming on board and making sure they're safe.
Once the Coast Guard safety inspectors are in your area, you can contact them via cell phone. The number to reach the inspectors in the Dillingham area is 439-5777, and in the King Salmon Naknek area, the contact numbers are 439-5778 or 439-5779. Once again, the Coast Guard inspectors will be in the Igigik area June 10th through the 15th, in the King Salmon Naknek area June 10th through the 22nd. Inspectors will be in Dillingham from June 13th through the 22nd. If your vessel is stored in one of the region's boatyards and it's ready to be inspected, you can put a life ring high up in the mast as a signal for the inspectors that you would like your vessel to be inspected. We'll be right back with more of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. This is KDLG's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. I'm Mike Mason. The Bristol Bay region is world famous for its one-of-a-kind sockeye salmon run. However, the region is also known for something entirely different, mining, or rather the potential of large-scale mining in the form of the proposed Pebble Mine. On Thursday, the Pebble Limited Partnership unveiled a new report that seeks to put some numbers on the potential economic impacts of the mine if it's ever developed. The new report is titled The Economic and Employment Contributions of a Conceptual Pebble Mine to the Alaska and United States Economies. It was prepared by the economic analysis and forecasting firm IHS. At its heart, the report seeks to gauge the positive economic impact a mine could have on the local economy, as well as the state and national economies. Bob Flanagan is the Director of Economic Impact Analysis for IHS.
In working with Pebble, we identified the fact that not all of the economic activity would occur within Alaska. There would be supply purchases and such from the lower 48. So that spending within the lower 48 then initiates another round of, or another level of economic impact that accrues to the country. So within the lower 48, during the initial production phase, we estimate that approximately 12,000 jobs would be supported on an annual basis.
The new report claims that during construction, the Pebble Mine could contribute $400 million a year to Alaska's gross state product and $1.6 billion a year to the U.S. gross domestic product. The report claims that during the first 25 years of production, the mine could increase Alaska's gross domestic product by $1.1 billion a year and the U.S. GDP by $2.4 billion a year. Flanagan says the economic benefits would spread beyond U.S. shores, but that was not included in the new report.
We did recognize that a portion of the capital expenditures, operating expenditures, would flow outside the United States, but that was beyond the scope of this particular project.
The new report anticipates the Pebble Limited Partnership will spend about $1.2 billion a year during construction and over $1 billion a year during the first 25 years of the mine life. If the production values are correct, the mine could expand total U.S. production by 20% above the 2011 production level of 1.1 million metric tons. While the mine might have a positive economic benefit to the Bristol Bay region, Alaska, and the nation as a whole, it also has the potential to damage the Bristol Bay region's massive commercial fishery for sockeye and other fishing-related industries. Flanagan admits the report does not directly compare the economic benefits of mining versus the fishing industry.
The scope of this project was focused on the development and the operations of the Pebble Mine, separate from all the other industries within the immediate area. So that, in other words, that assumes that the fishing industry and others are ongoing as they are currently, that there's no spillover effect from the Pebble Mine into the fishing industry.
A recent study by the University of Alaska's Institute of Social and Economic Research shows that the Bristol Bay sockeye fishery generates about $1.5 billion worth of value a year and supports about 12,000 jobs a year in both the fishing and processing industries. The report was prepared for the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, which represents all of Bristol Bay's driftnet fishermen. Bob Waldrop is the BBRSDA executive director. He believes the two reports can be used to compare the economic benefits of the two industries, mining and commercial fishing.
They used a measurement of jobs, both part-time, full-time jobs. And so that's the same measurement that a lot of our report focused on. And I believe that they came up with a number very similar to ours for their industry, the same one that we represent for our industry, the commercial fishing industry, which if they are largely offset, then it sort of forces more attention on the costs and consequences of a large-scale mine. And I don't think that there's any comparison to be made on those efforts. We create the 14,000 jobs with very little cost, just good common sense and good stewardship. It's really about all that goes into it, aside from wages and things that are productive, but there's no lingering costs after the fishery is over with. And there very much likely is, if the watershed assessment is correct, some lingering costs in perpetuity lingering. So I think the benefits sort of neutralize one another as the jobs. Then more attention might properly be focused on the consequences and costs of the project.
The recent study about the economic importance of the Bristol Bay salmon industry can be found on the BBRSDA website, and the new report focused on the economic benefits of the proposed Pebble Mine can be found on the website of the Pebble Limited Partnership. Earlier this year, the partnership noted that they plan to enter into permitting by the end of the year and will make their mine plan public prior to starting the NEPA permitting process. A woman involved in the seafood processing industry is trying to shed some light on why one area of Bristol Bay has a thriving small seafood processing industry, while another area has no small processors at all. The seafood processing industry in Bristol Bay is varied and diverse. There are large, medium, and small processors located in places like Dillingham, Naknek, Togiak, and Igigik, and each processor is unique in the products they produce. The local Marine Advisory Program agent for Bristol Bay recently wrote an opinion piece focused on something she's calling the industry cluster model. Isetta Chambers is also a member of the Bay's processing sector through her ownership interest in the small Naknek-based processor called Naknek Family Fisheries. Chambers claims that since about 2007, there have been several small mom-and-pop type operations that have formed in the Naknek King Salmon area. She notes that this cluster of small processors is missing on the west side of the bay in the Dillingham area. She's hoping that measures can be put in place in the Dillingham area to build on what's been done in the Naknek King Salmon area.
I would like to see an ice machine in every fishing area. I think that would be kind of the next logical step. And the big processors can facilitate that by offering ice to the processors as well. I guess that would be my recommendation, is you just can't have enough ice. as well as, you know, the infrastructure. There used to be a like a logistics provider, I guess, that would pick fish up and then bring it to the airport. Having that kind of service is really critical, especially for the direct marketers who are trying to do way too much with very little staff. A lot of the pieces are already here in Dillingham. It's just putting them together, and the real magic ingredient is the entrepreneurs themselves, and that's what I was trying to get across in my article. Infrastructure is, of course, critical, but having that inspiration, having that model to follow, and especially if those people are open with their information and willing to share it with others that might follow in their footsteps.
Almost all of the small processors that have survived in the Bay have done so by emphasizing quality, and often they pay a premium price to fishermen for high-quality fish that are chilled at the point of harvest or that are delivered to the processors very quickly after being harvested. Chambers says those small processors are producing a wide variety of products, but many of them are focused on producing sockeye fillets. Chambers claims the cluster of small seafood processors in the Naknek King Salmon area has had an impact on not just quality but price. She asserts the ex-vessel price of sockeye in Naknek last year was higher than it was in Dillingham, and often the small processors are paying a significantly better price than the major processors. Chambers suggests that 2013 is already shaping up to be a good year.
The people I'm talking to, there's a lot of enthusiasm, especially for the frozen vacuum-packed fillet. Of course, the volumes are expected to be less, and so people are cutting back in terms of their orders that they're able to fulfill. So that kind of leaves some of these smaller processors in a really ripe position to be able to garner those prices that they deserve for their more valuable products. And so I'm not saying that it's a seller's market out there, but I think that we're going to see some encouraging price changes, both on the processing side and the harvesting side. I don't want to make any predictions on price because a predecessor of mine did that and he got in a lot of trouble.
The 2013 sockeye salmon fishing season in the East Side districts begins on June 3rd. However, it's unlikely that date will coincide with the arrival of sockeye in Bristol Bay. The staking period for a shore fishery lease from the state of Alaska is now open through the middle of October. The application period is also open through mid-October. A shore fishery lease basically gives a set net fisherman the right to fish from a certain spot of state-owned tidelands. The leasing program is run by the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. Ryan Hickle is the program manager. He says a site that is staked with a subsequent application could be leased out by next year, 2014.
These are all leases for the following summer, because we have to go through a public notice process, and also because the application period is open until October 15th. So if someone applied, we have to wait till the application period closes to see if there are competing applications.
A shore fishery lease does not mean that a fisherman has a property right. Rather, a lease is a limited exclusive interest or first priority right to use a site. However, a lease only allows other fishermen to be excluded from a site only when the lessee is physically present and fishing. Hickel observed that now is the time to start the process if you don't have a lease for your set net site.
If someone is fishing a stretch of beach that they like, they can, you know, they can fish it for June or July, and then they can stake it in August and submit an application to us after that. You know, it's a good time to suss out if someone wants a lease in a particular location.
The state shore fishery leasing program was created in 1964 as a way to resolve user conflicts. The advent of the limited entry system in the mid-1970s resulted in just 2,200 set net permits across the entire state. DNR currently has 1,081 active leases, which means that many set netters don't have a lease. Hickel confirms that Bristol Bay features the largest concentration of both SetNet permits and SetNet leases. However, he says there are still SetNet sites available for lease.
But there's not a lot of room left close to Dillingham or in Quijack Bay or north and south of the mouth of the Naknek River. There's also not a ton of room north, the north bank of the Egigic River, but there's some room even in those places. There are still some openings where people haven't actually been issued a shore fishery lease. Now, further afield out in Togiak, Manicotak, or even further south along Dillingham Bay or out south along Quijack Bay, there's areas that are open for fishing, and no one's put a shore fishery lease down on them. So, yeah, and if people have any more questions about exactly where leases are and are not, they're more than welcome to give me a call or give any of my shorefish staff a call anytime. They can also go online themselves through our Alaska Mapper GIS website. They can actually find and see, you know, visibly where these shore fishery leases are currently at.
One of the biggest changes to the SetNet fishery in Bristol Bay is the Board of Fisheries' decision back in December to do away with the SetNet permit stacking system that allowed one person to own and fish two SetNet permits. Hickel says the leasing regulations are tied to fish and game regulations, which means that now a Bristol Bay SetNetter can only have one lease. In the past 3 years or so, staffers with the Shore Fishery Leasing Program have been publicly reaching out to SetNet fishermen to encourage them to take advantage of the protections provided by having a lease. Hickel believes those outreach efforts have been successful.
Because we've always been getting new lessees. Now, I guess you could, I guess it's arguable about whether, whether we could be getting more. And I think the reason that we don't get more is because exactly what you were kind of implying there is that a lot of people will consider a site to be their site because they've traditionally fished it, but the state doesn't recognize that it's their site, and if they don't have a shore fishery lease on it, and legally it's not their site, and I should qualify that by saying their site, it's not their site exclusively, it's their site exclusively for commercial set gill netting as long as they're fishing it. But other fishermen can come and fish there if they're not presently fishing their shore fishery lease. But what it does is it's basically kind of a form of insurance. Say that, hey, I've fished this area for a long time, or maybe you haven't, but if you are that person who thinks of their little stretch of beach as their traditional site and other people respect it, well, this is kind of a form of insurance saying that if a newcomer comes in and wants to fish it, they can't as long as you're actively fishing it.
The way the system works is that you must first stake a SetNet site before applying for a shore fishery lease. To stake a site, you need to place the stake at the net anchor point. That stake must be at least 3 feet above the ground and must support a sign showing the applicant's name, mailing address, limited entry permit number, and the staking date. Hickel is encouraging applicants to stake a site for 30 days before submitting a shore fishery lease application.
The next step is basically the public notice process, which consists of us sending it to us. We gather up all of our applications. We make sure that they've got valid limited entry permits, and for the applicable districts, and then we'll public notice other fishermen in the area. Not every fisherman, but we usually go 5 or 10 miles up the beach, or 5 miles in one direction, 5 miles in the other direction, rather. We'll public notice the closest landowners, boroughs, corporations, the applicable state agencies, and we'll put it on our website, and we'll also send it to post offices in the area, because that's actually a really good way of getting hold of people. And we were putting it in the papers in the past, but we weren't finding that that many people were getting notified that way. So that public notice period starts usually, it takes us a while to get everything together, but the public notice period usually starts in mid-December, runs for 45 days to the end of January. At that point in time, if there aren't any protests or competing applications, which we would then have to make decisions about, if there aren't, then we ask you to find a local draftsperson or surveyor and actually have a shore fishery plat drawn up. And after that's been completed and okayed by us, then we and you've paid all your applicable fees, and then we issue your shore fishery lease.
Once a shore fishery lease is given, it's good for 10 years. There are some costs associated with getting and maintaining a shore fishery lease, and as Hickel confirms, a lease can only be given to a SetNet permit holder. Once again, both the staking and application periods for a new shore fishery lease is currently open through October the 15th. Information about the state's shore fishery leasing program can be found on the website of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. You can also call the shore fishery staff. Their number is 269-8132. That concludes this edition of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report here on listener-supported public radio KDLG. The report can be downloaded from the KDLG website at kdlg.org. The report can be heard each Friday, Saturday, and Sunday during the fishing season. Airtime is straight up 4 p.m. Please join me for the next Bristol Bay Fisheries Report right here on listener-supported public radio KDLG. Until then, watch the weather, be safe, and good fishing.
The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is brought to you by the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, ensuring long-term growth in the world's greatest salmon fishery through investments in Bristol Bay science, infrastructure, marketing, and quality. The Bristol Bay RSDA. We're on board with you.